All right, so let's dive into this case, Transatlantic Financing Corp versus United States.
Yeah.
And it basically boils down to, like, when does too expensive actually become, like, legally impossible, right? Like, is there a point where a contract just becomes so outrageously expensive to fulfill that a court will say, nah, you don't have to do that?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question, right? Like, where's that line? And this case is super important because it set a precedent that we still see playing out in contracts today, especially when we're dealing with, like, global events that no one could have predicted.
Right, exactly. And what makes it even more interesting is that this whole thing started with a ship full of wheat. So picture this,
right?
It's 1956. The Cold War is, like, simmering in the background. And then, bam, out of nowhere, Egypt decides to nationalize the Suez Canal. Total chaos, right?
Yeah. I mean, the Suez Canal was the route for ships going between Europe and Asia at the time. Cut down travel time, cut down costs, huge. So when it suddenly closed, it was like a major shock to the global economy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, imagine, like, all those ships just suddenly stranded or having to make these crazy detours. It must have been a logistical nightmare.
Totally. And right in the middle of all this, you've got Transatlantic Financing Corp. They'd made this deal to ship wheat from the U.S. to Iran. Their ship, the SS Christos, set sail, like, early October 1956. A few weeks later, boom, the canal is closed.
Oh, wow. Talk about bad timing. So what happens next? Does the ship just, like, sit there and wait?
Well, they had a choice, right? Wait and see if the canal reopens, which could take who knows how long, or take the long, expensive way around Africa, you know, around the Cape of Good Hope.
Yeah, not exactly a quick trip. So what did they do?
They took the long way, added weeks to the journey, added a ton of money to their costs. Understandably, Transatlantic was not happy about this.
No kidding. So they sue. Right. Like, who do they sue?
They sued the U.S. government for the extra costs. Their argument was essentially, hey, this Suez crisis, this wasn't part of the deal, this wasn't in the contract. This closure has made the contract impossible to fulfill under the original terms, so you gotta cover our extra costs.
Hmm, that's interesting. So the court had to decide, like, was this closure a legitimate get-out-of-jail-free card or just a costly inconvenience that Transatlantic was stuck with? What were the arguments back and forth?
Yeah. It was a big deal. I mean, the court applied a three-part test to figure out if fulfilling the contract was actually impossible, right? First, was the event unexpected?
Okay, that seems pretty straightforward in this case.
Yeah. The Suez Canal closing, total surprise. So that box was definitely checked.
Round one to Transatlantic. What about part two?
Part two gets a little trickier.
Yeah.
Did the contract itself, or maybe some common practice in the shipping industry, say who was responsible for this kind of thing?
Okay, so did it.
Here's where things get interesting. The contract didn't actually say anything about who eats the cost if a major shipping route gets blocked. It was totally silent on that point.
Oh, wow. That's a big oversight.
Yeah.
So how did the court interpret that silence? What did they do with that?
They looked at what was typical in the shipping business. Basically, the court said, come on, you're in the shipping business. You know this stuff happens. Global events can disrupt routes. This isn't some crazy, unheard of scenario. You know, kind of like an unwritten rule of the game.
Right. So it's like the court was saying, look, you should have seen this coming, Transatlantic, and maybe factored in some crisis insurance or something into your pricing.
Exactly. It's about understanding the inherent risks of the business you're in, right?
Okay. So that brings us to the third part of the test, right?
Yeah.
And this is the big one, right?
Yeah. The million-dollar question. Did the Suez closure make this contract commercially senseless? And ultimately, the court decided no.
Okay, wait. Help me understand that. Why wasn't going all the way around Africa considered commercially senseless? I mean, that's got to add a ton of cost, right?
It did, but the increase was only about 10%. The court compared this to other cases where cost increases were way higher, like 35% or more. In those situations, they might have sided with the impossible argument. But 10%, not enough to break the deal, especially since the ship could still make the longer trip.
So it's not just about something being possible, but about whether it's, like, financially crippling to actually do it. There's a kind of a threshold of pain the court's looking for.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a really important point for anyone drafting contracts, right? What's a reasonable expectation of risk? What crosses the line into true commercial absurdity? This case helps answer that.
Now, I heard that Transatlantic tried to use a legal maneuver here. They tried to use this concept called quantum meruit. What was that all about?
Ah, yes, their quantum meruit gambit. It's Latin for as much as he deserves, basically. It's a way for someone to get paid for work they did, even if there wasn't a formal contract.
Okay, interesting. So how do they try to apply that here?
Well, they did accept the original payment for the wheat shipment, But then they turned around and sued separately for those extra costs from the detour. They were trying to kind of play both sides, right? Benefit from the original contract while also claiming it was impossible to fulfill.
Hmm. Clever. But it sounds like trying to have their cake and eat it too. Did the court let them get away with that?
Not a chance. The court saw right through it. You can't cherry pick parts of a contract to uphold, right? Either stick with the original agreement or you declare it void and ask for a fair price for the entire job.
Yeah, so no double dipping allowed. That seems pretty fair.
Right. The court wanted consistency, you know. You can't claim a contract is valid for some parts and impossible for others. You got to pick a lane.
This transatlantic case, it really gets into the weeds of impossible contracts. But we've been using that term impossibility. But there are also these other concepts like impracticability and frustration of purpose. And these get thrown around in contract law, but they're not quite the same thing, right?
Absolutely. It's really important to distinguish between them. Impossibility is the strictest standard. It literally means that the contract can't be performed at all because something happened that no one could have foreseen. Like if that ship carrying the wheat had actually sunk in a storm, that'd be impossibility.
Okay, so something literally, physically impossible to do.
Got it.
So where does impracticability fit in?
Impracticability acknowledges that a contract might become so difficult, so commercially unreasonable, that it's practically impossible to do what you originally agreed to, even if it's technically still possible. Think back to transatlantic. Sailing around Africa was possible, but the extra cost made it incredibly tough to fulfill the contract the way they originally planned.
Right, so impracticability is more about extreme difficulty, not literal impossibility.
Okay.
And what about frustration of purpose? Where does that fit in?
So frustration of purpose comes in when something unexpected happens that completely undermines the reason for the contract in the first place, even if it could still technically be performed. For example, imagine you rent a room specifically to watch a parade, but then the parade gets canceled. You could still use the room, but the whole point of renting it is gone. That's frustration of purpose.
Okay. I see. So they're related, but they have distinct legal meanings. It's like traits of impossible, right?
Yeah, exactly. Understanding the nuances is super important when you're dealing with contracts, especially when unexpected events throw a wrench in the works.
All right. So let's pause here and take a breath. When we come back, we'll explore how transatlantic shaped the way we actually write contracts today, particularly those what if the world goes crazy clauses.
So welcome back to our deep dive into transatlantic financing.
All right, so we were talking about how this case, transatlantic, really got people thinking about those force majeure clauses, you know, those parts of a contract that deal with all the what ifs, like what happens if the world goes crazy.
Mm. Right, exactly. I mean, transatlantic showed everyone that courts aren't just going to let you off the hook because something unexpected happened and suddenly your deal gets a bit pricier. You know, you can't just say, oh, well, force majeure, too bad. This case really made it clear that you need to be super specific in your contracts about who's responsible when those what ifs actually happen.
So if I'm writing a contract,
yeah,
I can't just like throw in some vague acts of God clause or war clause and call it a day.
No, not if you want to sleep well at night. Transatlantic really highlighted how vague clauses just lead to more disputes and headaches down the road. So what we started seeing after this case were much more detailed force majeure clauses that laid out like specific scenarios. It's like having a risk allocation roadmap built right into your contract.
So instead of just saying delays, I should spell out what kinds of delays would let someone off the hook, like supplier issues, transportation problems, natural disasters, like all that stuff.
Exactly. You got to get specific. And this applies to all kinds of contracts, by the way, not just for international shipping.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So what else did we learn from transatlantic? Anything else kind of stand out?
Well, it also really reinforced this distinction between impracticability, which usually falls under the Uniform Commercial Code, that's the UCC, for stuff like buying and selling goods, and then you have frustration of purpose, which is more of a common law thing that applies to other types of contracts.
Right. We kind of touched on that before, but I think we need to unpack that a bit more for our listeners. Why does that distinction even matter? Like, why should they care?
Because depending on what kind of contract you're looking at, the rules for getting out of it can be different, right? So if you're talking about selling widgets, the UCC's impracticability standard is probably what you're looking at. But if it's like a lease for a storefront, you might be dealing with common law frustration of purpose.
So knowing what kind of contract you're in, that's crucial. It's like choosing the right tool for the job.
Right.
Exactly. There's no one size fits all in contract law, unfortunately.
Now, this reminds me of something we discussed earlier, foreseeability. The court in Transatlantic, they made a point of saying that just because you could have predicted a problem doesn't automatically mean the risk has been allocated. Can you explain that? Because it seems a bit counterintuitive, you know?
Yeah, it's tempting to think that if you could have seen it coming, you should have prepared for it, right? But legally speaking, it doesn't always work that way. What Transatlantic shows us is that even if both parties are aware of some potential risks, like, hey, canals could close, right? The contract still needs to actually spell out who takes the hit if that risk actually happens.
So even if everyone knows something could go wrong, if the contract's silent on who's responsible, then, well, you're in trouble.
That's the lesson, for sure. Don't leave those things to chance. Spell it out, black and white, in the contract.
Okay, so let's circle back to that quantum Aruit strategy that Transatlantic tried to pull. Seems like that kind of backfired big time. Can you remind us why that didn't work?
Sure, so remember, quantum Aruit basically means getting paid for the work you did do, even if there's no formal contract. And Transatlantic tried to use this to basically get a little extra cash.
So how did they try to like make that work? How did that play out?
Well, they took the original payment for the weight shipment, right? But then they turned around and sued separately for those extra costs they racked up because of that detour. They were basically saying, hey, we deserve to get paid twice, once for the original deal, and then again for all the hassle of that detour.
Wow. Talk about adding insult to injury. So what did the court think about that?
Yeah, not a good look. The court wasn't buying it at all. They saw this as a pretty blatant attempt to, double dip. Their logic was, look, if Transatlantic really thought the contract was void because of the Suez closure, then they should have gone for quantum Meruit for the whole voyage, not just those extra costs.
Oh, so you can't just pick and choose when the contract is valid and when it's not. Right. It's
Yeah.
like all or nothing.
Exactly. The court was really sending a clear message with this. You can't just take the good parts of a contract and then ditch the bad parts when things get a little tough.
Seems pretty fair to me. Are there any other, like, big lessons we can take from Transatlantic? Anything we haven't touched on yet?
Yeah, I think there are a few more things worth noting. First, the court really emphasized this idea of the community interest in contract enforcement. They weren't eager to just rewrite agreements simply because one side was facing some difficulty.
So there's a strong presumption that we're going to uphold these contracts as they're written, even when things change.
Right. Contracts are supposed to provide stability and predictability. Courts don't want to mess with that unless there's a really good reason.
Okay, that makes sense. Anything else?
Well, Transatlantic also kind of touched on the role of insurance in all of this. The court basically said, look, Transatlantic's a shipping company. They were in a much better position to buy insurance against these kinds of risks, like canal closures and stuff.
So even though the contract didn't specifically say who was responsible for that risk, the court thought Transatlantic should have taken steps to manage that risk on their own.
Yep, that's the idea. It's a good reminder that risk management goes beyond what's written in the contract itself,
Okay. Well, we've covered a lot of ground here in part two. When we come back in the final part of our deep dive, we'll look at some concrete examples of how Transatlantic is still influencing legal thinking and contract drafting today. Welcome back to the final part of our deep dive into transatlantic financing. I mean, it's kind of wild, right? A case from like the 1950s, and we're still talking about it today. It still matters.
Yeah, it's a testament to how important this case was. It wasn't just about settling one specific dispute. It really set the stage for how we think about contracts, especially when things go sideways.
Right, exactly. So we've talked about like the big picture takeaways, but let's get down to brass tacks, right? Can you give us some real-world examples of how Transatlantic is still making an impact? Like, how does this actually play out in practice?
Sure. So one really clear example is in the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, which covers a ton of commercial transactions, right? The official comments to Section 2615, the one that deals with impracticability, they actually mention increased costs specifically. And they basically say, look, just because the price went up, that alone isn't enough to get you out of a contract. There needs to be something unexpected, some event that really changes the nature of what you agreed to do.
So, like in Transatlantic, they're saying, yeah, things got more expensive, but can you still technically do what you promised? If the answer is yes, then, well, you're probably stuck.
Exactly. And that's where the whole idea of risk allocation comes in, which is another huge lesson from Transatlantic. Courts are going to look really closely at whether the contract itself, or maybe some standard practice in your industry, puts the responsibility for a specific risk on one party or the other.
Okay, so let's make this practical.
Right.
Say I'm writing a contract for like a construction project. What kind of transatlantic inspired clauses should I be thinking about? What should I keep in mind?
Well, in construction, you've got like a million things that could go wrong, right? You've got labor strikes, material shortages, weather delays, you know, maybe the building codes change, all that fun stuff. So a well-written contract is going to anticipate those risks and spell out exactly who's responsible if they happen.
So instead of just saying like delays are possible, I need to be specific about what kinds of delays would like let one party walk away or who pays for the extra costs if there is a delay, right?
Exactly. The more specific you can be, the better. Less room for arguments later on.
It's all about, you know, preventing those legal headaches down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about international shipping contracts?
Yeah.
What should people be thinking about there, especially given what happened with the Suez Canal in transatlantic?
Right. Transatlantic really highlighted how important the whole issue of routes is. Right. So if your contract involves goods moving through a specific canal or shipping lane, you got to think about what happens if that route gets shut down. Who's got the risk there? Who's going to pay for a detour? The contract needs to deal with that stuff directly.
Because if it doesn't, the court might just say, well, you're in the shipping business. You should have known this was a possibility.
Right. They'll say you should have planned for this. Silence in a contract can cost you a lot of money.
Now, I know that transatlantic set a pretty high bar for actually proving impracticability, but I'm curious about cases where that argument did work. I understand there's a case, Mineral Park Land Co. v. Howard, that's where a big cost increase did get someone out of a contract. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, absolutely. So in Mineral Park, you have this contractor who agreed to, like, extract gravel from a property. They thought most of it would be above the water table, easy to get to. But it turned out almost all of it was underwater. That made the whole extraction process way, way more expensive than they thought it would be.
So unlike transatlantic, where the cost went up by like 10%, here we're talking about a much bigger difference.
Oh, yeah. Huge difference. The cost of getting that underwater gravel, it was like 10 times higher than they originally figured. And the court said, nope, that level of cost increase, that makes this contract commercially impractical.
So Mineral Park shows that it's possible, although difficult, to convince a court that a contract has become, you know, basically impossible because it's just way too expensive now.
Right. It usually comes down to how big the cost increase is and whether the problem was something no one could reasonably foreseen.
Okay. So I think we've given our listeners, you know, plenty to chew on here. Any final words of wisdom as we wrap up our deep dive into transatlantic? Anything you want to leave folks with?
I guess I'd just say this. Transatlantic is a great reminder that, you know, being clear is super important. When you're writing contracts, really think through the potential risks. Be very specific about who's responsible if those risks become a reality. And use language that everyone can understand. You know, it's always better to have these tough conversations up front rather than end up duking it out in court later.
Words to live by. Thanks for walking us through this deep dive into transatlantic financing. I think it's safe to say that this is the case every lawyer and law student should know. And hopefully we've given everyone listening a good grasp on why. See you next time.